I think we're all very excited. I know I am to hear our next speaker. He's one of us. He's a guide dog user. He is a well-traveled gentleman, from what I've been able to read and hear. And he is the He is the CEO of the Seeing Eye, Miss. Doctor, again, I'm getting my doctors and misters mixed up here, Dr. Jim Kutch, and let's hear it for Jim. And
thank you, and it's a delight to be here. Vegas dog number 8 is here behind my seat up in the front of the room. So I've been doing this since 1970 when I got my first dog at the Seeing Eye when I was a freshman in college. So my various dogs collectively have a lot of miles under their paws. The abstract for this talk says the other side of guide dogs, legislation, IGDF, and organizers asked me to talk a little bit about working at the Seeing Eye, and I said how I came to get the best job in the world. So to talk about the IGDF, the International Guide Dog Federation, to talk about Dusty's Law, the recent legislation we enacted in New Jersey or helped to enact in New Jersey, and why I think I have the best job in the world, any one of those could easily be an hour talk. So I'm sure they put 3 hours on the program for me this afternoon. I'm getting poked in the rib here. But I have 30 minutes to cover all those things. So I'm going to have to talk really fast. You're going to have to listen really fast over the next little while. But I'm also going to speak tomorrow at the GDC lunch. So I'll cover a few more things at that lunch. But let's start with the IGDF. The IGDF is the International Guide Dog Federation. And the idea of this federation dates all the way back to conferences held in Europe in the 1970s. At a conference in Vienna in 1983, after the discussions in several conferences in the 70s, the conference in Vienna in 83, they actually charged a group of individuals to create sort of a working group to look at the formulation of guide dog standards to be applied to the schools all around the world, and specifically to the training of the dogs and the instruction of blind people in the use of the dogs. Again, that group consisted of European dog guide schools. That's where the IGDF got its origin. That led to another meeting in 1986 in Leamington, England. And at that time, 28 delegates from 15 different schools in 10 different countries around the world considered the recommendations of this working group. And what followed were several more international meetings. It takes a long time to do anything at the international level. Some of you have probably worked at international levels. There's a lot of cultures, a lot of countries, a lot of customs, a lot of things to consider. But after a lot of revisions to the plan and other things took place, the IGDF was officially established in April of 1989. The new organization was created with certain specific focuses. Access was one of them, animal breeding, care of the animals, and veterinary practices, funding opportunities for dog guide schools, staff selection and training, student selection and training. Those were the original principles, and specifically the IGDF organization was set up to allow the member organizations around the world to communicate with each other, to exchange information and experience in the areas of breeding, training, handling, assessing dogs, to act as a body that will offer advice and counsel to its member organizations. And in 1992, the organization began inspecting its member schools, and that's what led to today's accreditation programs. Schools were accredited by an appointed assessor who visits the school and then measures that school on a set of operational guidelines. By 1996, the organization had 46 members, and they had conducted their first seminar internationally and that theme for that seminar was specifically on breeding. In the late 1990s, the U.S. was kind of late to the game. Most of this was going on internationally, most in Europe and Australia, other places, New Zealand. But the United States came on board in the late 1990s, when most of the U.S. schools, most of the U.S. Star Guide schools, came on board and all submitted membership applications. Now, it's important to understand that if a school is a member of the IGDF, it means they are accredited. That's the only kind of members. And accreditation is similar to accreditation in other disciplines, in other areas. Many universities are accredited. Many veterinary hospitals are accredited. Many regular hospitals are accredited. And so are certain professional organizations accredit their member organizations. So the only members of IGDF are schools, and the only schools that are members are those that have passed the accreditation. So the U.S. schools came on in the late 1990s. The CEI specifically had its first accreditation review in 1998, and we have been a member of the IGDF, an accredited member, obviously, ever since. Today, there are 86 accredited schools around the world in 26 countries who are members of the IGDF. 12 of those accredited members are here in the United States, and 5 of them are in Canada. All of these schools now get together every other year, or at least they're invited to get together, and most do come, at an international seminar. And the standards have developed over time as well. Now there are close to 100 different requirements for all the different schools that are broken into a series of 10 chapters within the standards document. As examples, there's a chapter on dog breeding standards, kennels and kennel management, vehicles and facilities, training of the dogs, instruction of students, selection and application processes, veterinary care for the dogs in the program, etc. Those are just some of the examples of the areas in which the accreditation review covers. Schools are assessed every 5 years, so if you're a member of the IGDF, you're not a member for life. The school has to go through the entire accreditation review, the assessment again, every 5 years. And you must meet all the standards in order to remain a member. And the standards evolve also. Every year, half of the standards are reviewed and potentially modified. Not every standard is modified every year, but let's face it, we're in a changing world. The demands that we face as guide dog users are different than they were 20 or 30 years ago. So clearly the standards need to evolve to meet the demands that we are putting on ourselves and our dogs as we work with guide dogs as students, as graduates and clients of the various programs around the world. The accreditation consists of a 3-day visit by an assessor who is assigned by the IGDF and may not come from the same country of the school that's being assessed. So anybody who assesses schools in the United States comes from a non-U.S. school, and the same is applied all around the world. Paperwork is submitted in advance by the school. A fairly substantial amount of paperwork has to be submitted. A major set of questions is submitted to the school ready for accreditation, and they fill all that out, and then the assessor comes, spends 3 days, and talks to a sample set of graduates, a sample set of students, some puppy raisers, staff members all over the organization, observes training, and so on. And basically, the schedule, what the assessor wants to see, is set by the assessor. So no school, two schools will have exactly the same experience because the assessor is intended to determine what to assess based on this previously submitted material for the accreditation review. After the assessor does the assessment, he or she writes up a complete report and a recommendation, and that goes through two levels of review before it's finally approved. First, there is an accreditation committee of the IGDF, and they meet. Their representatives, it's a four-member panel from all around the world, and they meet and review what happens, what the assessor found during the assessment and what his or her report is. And then that committee makes a recommendation to the board of the IGDF, and the board is the one who finally makes the decision to bestow accreditation or not on the member school. Well, what happens if you don't pass accreditation? If it's a minor reason that a school didn't pass the accreditation, they are given a limited amount of time, usually a few months, to remediate an issue that was uncovered during the assessment. And if they successfully, within the time limit prescribed, if they successfully remediate the problem, then the school receives their accreditation. But if a school doesn't fix it or it's an egregious problem, then accreditation is withdrawn from the organization. So that's what happens within the IGDF. It's a very important program internationally. It's great to have a minimum set of standards all around the world so that those of us who are applying for dogs, when I apply, I get some comfort in knowing that I'm applying to a school that's IGDF accredited. Now, that's my personal choice. Not all schools have to be accredited, in the same way not all hospitals or university programs need to be accredited. But many do, many are, and it's an extra sort of assurance as you look at the schools. You have a good faith sense that the 12 accredited schools in the U.S. have gone through this accreditation and have met all the 12 standards. And by the way, all three of the schools here in California are accredited members of the IGDF. The list is available of accredited schools around the world on the IGDF's website, which can be found at igdf.org.uk. Remember, our IGDF offices are located in London. Well, what else does this mean to us as we consider where to get schools? I said we know they've met the minimum requirements, and we know that the school is serious enough about what they're doing to have sought that accreditation. But there's another piece that's also important for those of you that may be considering international travel. I'm going to talk more about this at the luncheon tomorrow. But here in the United States, travel is authorized under access, taxi cabs, hotels. The fact that we're here in this hotel today, many of us with dogs, falls under the ADA. The ADA doesn't apply in the rest of the world. That's something only here in the United States. And in many countries of the world, access is dependent on the dog coming from an IGDF accredited school. So written into those countries' access laws is a requirement that the dog, the guide dog, comes from an IGDF accredited school. So that's a factor to consider besides the ones I mentioned before. And we'll talk more about that, as I said, tomorrow. Let me switch gears and talk a little bit about legislation. I mentioned the ADA. As you all know, there's three laws that really apply to us, the ADA, the Fair Housing Act, and the Air Carrier Access Act. All of those involve setting forth rights for those of us that are using guide dogs, and a lot of other rights for non-dog guide users. I'll get that right. I'm going to digress for a minute. For many decades, the Seeing Eye thought, and two of the other schools, the first couple of other schools, we all agreed that when we were talking about a generic dog, we were going to say dog guide. And so the Seeing Eye and the other U.S. schools that were around at the time, this was in the 50s, we all agreed to do that. And over time, the legislation kind of left us behind. Nobody talks about dog guides in the ADA or the Fair Housing Act or anywhere else. They talk about guide dogs. And all the rest of the schools were pretty quick to change the language, but the Seeing Eye kind of hung on to that a little bit too long. And until about 10 years ago, we were still talking dog guide. So we suddenly realized that we weren't doing very well in Google searches for guide dog. So we have changed our policy, and we now use the two terms interchangeably, and I sort of switch back and forth between those a lot when I talk. So I will say dog guide in the old-style seeing eye way, and we all know I mean guide dog, and we'll all say guide dog as well, lowercase letters, of course. Okay. So a lot of work had to be done early on in access laws. One of the things that our co-founder, Morris Frank, did, Seeing Eye was founded in 1929. In the 30s and 40s, at a time when there were no other guide dog schools in the U.S., Morris Frank was sort of a one-person show traveling the country fighting for access rights. There's many historic articles of Morris having the first Seeing Eye dog, because that's all there were at the time, on a train, on an airplane, in a hotel, and so on. And today we think perhaps that the need for legislation is behind us, but I'm here to say that it isn't. There's a lot of legislation that's still required to really further define access and problems. And one of the big problems that we had been focusing on at the Seeing Eye, which affects all of us, regardless of what brand is on the harness of your guide dog. One of the things that bothers us is loose and uncontrolled dogs. There's quite a problem with loose and uncontrolled dogs. In a survey that we at the Seeing Eye conducted of any guide dog user, regardless of school, we did this in 2011. My wife Ginger was a key part of putting this survey together, and the Seeing Eye conducted this survey. We found out that over 80%, that's 80, 80% of the respondents to our survey from all of the U.S. schools had reported that they had experienced interference to them as a working team as they walked the streets. Over 40% had actually experienced an attack from a loose or poorly controlled dog. These are awful numbers. Over 70% of those incidences took place within a 30-minute walk of the person's home. So this is not somebody going to, you know, some other town and or other area or an area where dogs run wild or whatever. This was in the guide dog user's home area. If you want to read the entire report, it's interesting reading. You can find it under our Guide Dog Protection section of the Seeing Eye website, www.seeingeye.org/access. In many states around the United States, there is some legislation on attacks from loose and uncontrolled dogs on guide dogs, but it usually falls in the civil code, the civil chapter of the state legislation. That means that local animal control officers are dispatched to investigate. And that's a problem because in many jurisdictions, animal control officers work limited hours or in some smaller jurisdictions, maybe even only part-time hours. So if you experience an attack on a Friday afternoon and you call it in and they say, well, we'll send somebody by to investigate Monday afternoon, it doesn't do us a lot of good. If my dog is attacked while I'm walking somewhere, I need somebody to respond now. As a blind person, I can't later or even then describe what the dog looked like that attacked my dog. My answer is, I don't know, some dog. Where did it come from? Well, I don't know. It sounded like it came from that yard. Who was with the dog? Where did the dog go after the attack? These are questions that I'm not going to be able to answer as a blind person using my guide dog. And certainly anyone else who can help answer those questions isn't going to be around days later when the animal control officer is available. And this isn't, I'm not being negative about animal control officers. They have their job, and this just isn't part of it. It's not a priority. Further, if my dog is seriously injured in an attack, he can no longer lead me home or to his vet's office. So I'm essentially at the side of the road with a broken down car. Now I have no way to move further from there. That's not to mention the disorienting effects that can happen in an attack. You get dogs flying around you, barking, and your dog is scuffling and so on. It's very easy to get disoriented, no matter how good you are at orientation in your environment. So what we set out to do in New Jersey was to create effective legislation on attacks and interference and place it in the criminal code, not the civil code. And it's not that... Thank you. It's not that we wanted to send everybody off to jail. That wasn't the intent here. But what we did want is to ensure a police response. And any offense that's in the criminal code assures that if you call 911, the police will respond then and there. So that was the motivation to put it into the criminal code. As many of you know, changing legislation is not something you do in a few minutes or overnight. This is a multi-month, multi-year process. It took, in our case, 3 years and several very, very dedicated individuals to pull this off in the state of New Jersey. One of these individuals was a puppy raiser named Roger. Roger was walking his seeing eye puppy in his own neighborhood a few blocks away from his home when a dog ran out an open door of another house and attacked his dog. Roger was trying to protect his puppy, who kind of didn't know where this came from and what was going on. You know, all of our guide dogs from all of our programs are bred to be peaceful, calm, well-behaved, and they're not expecting random attacks of violence from other dogs. So you can imagine what this puppy is feeling, and Roger was trying to defend the puppy. Roger actually lost permanently a portion of one finger in the attack. Four of the puppy's teeth were smashed out when the attacking dog knocked the puppy into the sidewalk, and the pup received over 100 stitches from this attack, and ultimately, unfortunately, had to be dropped from our program. What's often not known is although dogs can frequently heal from the physical injuries, the emotional trauma, the mental trauma to a guide dog from an attack is just unbelievable, and they're just often not able to be rehabilitated and brought back into service after an attack like this. So that puppy's name was Dusty, and when Dusty retired from the program, Roger was one of the people who worked with us at the Seeing Eye diligently over, as I said, many years, three and a half years, to bring this to pass, and we called the legislation Dusty's Law in honor of the puppy Dusty. The first draft of this law, the legislature, the state legislators wanted to put it in the civil code again. So we had major debates and discussions and many visits to our state capitol. We had several of our graduate dogs there. We had several dogs from puppy raiser families that were there. And we had dogs from other programs because the law in the end is not just about guide dogs. It's about any service animal. And we really need to learn, I think, this is a personal philosophy here. I think we need to learn as people with disabilities to collaborate a little more with other people with other disabilities. And we collaborated with many other schools training other kinds of service animals in the passing of Dusty's Law. And we've put a lot of emphasis on the handler's safety and this need for round-the-clock police response if a person with a guide dog is attacked, or their dog is attacked, rather, by a loose or uncontrolled dog. And we were finally able to get the legislators to agree to that, and Dusty's Law was assigned into effect in 2014. So New Jersey at that time joined many other states. We were thinking, wow, the Seeing Eye's in New Jersey, and we don't have a good law in our own state. Some states do have very good laws. I encourage you to look, if you're here from California, look at the California laws. If you're from another nearby state, look at your own laws and see what you have in your own state and decide whether it's something that needs a little work. Is it in the civil code? Is it in the criminal code? And how effective is it in providing what you need? This is one of the few statutes around the country that provides the same protection for puppies in training to be guide dogs. That's an extra protection that we put into this effect in effect in New Jersey. So legislation isn't over. The need for advocacy isn't over. The need for all of us as users to come together and do this isn't over. And certainly the need for the Seeing Eye as a school, and really all the rest of the schools as well, to be involved in continuing to fight for needed access, needed legislation. There's all sorts of other issues. You know, taxi cabs are a problem for a lot of us. Those of you that are married to other blind people, there seems to be this, it's not a linear thing, it seems to be exponential. You know, if you have one guide dog user has trouble, if two of you are trying to get in the same cab, you might think you have twice as much trouble. No, you have 4 or 10 times as much trouble when there's two involved. So I encourage you all to stay involved, be involved. There are compromises in legislation. Did we get everything we want in New Jersey? No. Did we get enough of what we wanted for it to be highly effective? Yes. And I think that's another important lesson from what we did with Dusty's Law. If we had tried to continue for every single point that we wanted in the legislation, we wouldn't have a law signed into effect in 2014. We'd be still giving talks and debates and so on. So I think the art of compromise is also important. So that leaves me about 1.5 minutes to talk about why I think I have the best job in the world. And so we might defer a little of this tomorrow. I've had a lot of jobs over the years. I started, my first job out of college was to work at the university's electrical engineering department. And it was interesting because I started college as an electrical engineering major, and that lasted 2 days. On the second day on campus, the chemistry department said that a blind person couldn't take chemistry. Now, this was a long time before the laws and regulations we have today, and I was a freshman, and I wasn't much of a mind to fight with the university. And the electrical engineer department said, if you can't take freshman chemistry, you can't be an engineer. So I switched majors to some other stuff and later wound around in computer science and later was hired by the electrical engineering department. I often wondered why. I ran into my freshman advisor one day in the hall and he said, "Oh, you're still on campus, what are you doing these days?" And I said, "Yeah, I am, I work here for your department." Some of you who know me know my blindness and loss of most of my right hand was caused by misadventures in chemistry in high school. And so I often wondered later if the chemistry department just didn't know how to deal with blind guys in chemistry, freshman chemistry, or if they didn't want this particular blind guy in freshman chemistry after they heard about what happened in high school. So anyway, I do think I have the best job in the world. I was a university professor for a while, and I thought I had the best job in the world there because it was absolutely incredible to watch the difference that 4 years of college made in all of our students at the university. And now at the Seeing Eye, I get to see that in 4 weeks. The difference bringing a person in for their first dog. Think back, those of you that have dogs, and those of you that don't have dogs, why not? You imagine what it would be like to have a dog. You don't have to come to the Seeing Eye. There are 12 accredited schools, and they're all great. But we get to watch in 4 weeks an incredible difference in a person's life when they train and are matched with and start working with a guide dog. I'm going to leave it at that, and we'll talk more tomorrow so that I can stay on time. Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk. And if time allows, I'll do as many questions until they give me the hook.
Okay. Well, since
I probably already have the hook.
I'm going to encourage everybody to go to that luncheon tomorrow. So therefore, we're going to move on to our next speaker. But before we do, I just want to recognize Guide Dog Users of California, who's been working with some of us, because they have taken up the cudgel for improved legislation in this area. And they're going to be working on getting that introduced next year. So let's hear it for GDUC. Okay. We have two speakers. Oh, before we, one of our speakers is going to, you've been sitting so nicely and paying such attention that I'm breaking down and giving you a door prize. And one more after the speakers, before you go. So this time we're going to have Starbucks, and is it going to be with a mug? Oh, a $25 gift card and a mug. And Lisa Ells, one of our speakers, we're going to let her draw it. Charlene Ornelas, are you in the room? All right. Cafe au lait.